Pull, 3-2-IW.
Okay, this is probably better. I cut back on the power, that's what I did. You know, I think starts to get hot. So I put a fan in near it. So this is probably better, I think.
Roger, Dad, you're back to full quieting again. So, is it number 3 that's really going to be there for the extra 10 years when it's finished? And is number 2 going to be abandoned? And too bad there isn't a way of taking the hardware of number 2 and combining it with 3. Seems like it's a wasteful approach to have two separate spacecraft, two separate space stations up there for a period of time. K2RIW.
Yeah, well, that's what they're going to do. They're gonna jump this one, just like they jumped the first one. So you're gonna have a number 3 is the permanent one. Things we just made to, you know, protest, really. So similar to what the Russians did. Russians had the Salyut 1, Salyut 2. You know, they had like 4 different space stations up there before they ever got involved with Mir. They tried the 7, but a couple of them didn't work out. They crashed back into the sea or something. They never made it up there. But they had, you know, Salyut 1, Salyut 3, Salyut 5, I think, and 7 was a long-term one. That was up there. At one point, they had Mir and Salyut 7 at the same time. And they actually had the Russians go from one space station to the other. They docked with one, they undocked and went to the other one. That was pretty cool. But that was back in the Skylodge time, you know, back in the 70s. That's pretty much it. Just wanted to talk about something with the Hubble. You always talk about the Hubble being serviced. Now they're thinking about eventually doing that. Time with a spacecraft that hasn't flown yet, but it's called the Dream Chaser. We talked about it before. I'm dropping it. Dream Chaser spacecraft is being built by SNC, Sierra Nevada Corporation, and probably will first fly toward the end of 2019, and that'll have it'll be used as a cargo vehicle. Designed as a cargo vehicle. It was originally being designed to carry people, but then NASA gave them a contract, a fine contract, to deliver at least 6 cargo flights to the space station. But Sierra Nevada Corporation is still also in the planning of creating the same vehicle, except with people on it. So now it's thinking about this, you know, nowhere. Fine contracts or anything. If the Hubble should last long enough, and if the Dream Chaser is developed with a crew, there's a possibility that they could eventually use Dream Chaser as a vehicle to get to the Hubble to service it. Question is whether or not it's worth that money. You're going to have other telescopes, you know, floating in space by that time, so it's going to be worth it. Yeah, but if it is, a lot of scientists think that it is, they probably will eventually go ahead with something like that. So Hubble still has a shot, Dick. I had to bring that up. We were talking about it, I think, 2 weeks ago. We didn't have a net last week, and then somewhere in between that time, this article came out. So just go back to the Chinese space stations. I've been covering the development of this whole Chinese program for years, so I'm sure of the way it is with 1, 2, and 3. I'm not sure about the article. If they were talking about that right, if they said 2 is going to be part of that space station, that's not the case. Back to you.
A pessimistic person would say, gee, James Webb is going to be launched next year. It's a much bigger telescope with much higher capability. Therefore, we don't need Hubble anymore. Well, stand by. James Webb is a primarily infrared telescope. Hubble is primarily an optical and a little bit of infrared and some ultraviolet. So because the spectrum is so different, and there's never enough space time on these space-mounted telescopes, I'm convinced that there's enough merit to continue maintaining Hubble. I'm having trouble believing, once again, that although they talk about abandoning Hubble, and you think you've got replaceable hardware, like James Webb, James Webb is at a different wavelength. And so I'm not convinced that Webb will completely replace Hubble. And because Webb has got so much more capability, let me drop it, and so much more narrow beam width, the good news is it's got higher gain to look at weaker signals with higher resolution. The bad news is because it's got a narrower beam width, it doesn't look at as much sky. And therefore, there's always going to be 10 times more demand than you've got space time, telescope time. So you're going to need both of our vehicles as I see it. And so, sure it'd be nice if there was a version of Dream Chaser or something like it that not only could do maintenance, manned maintenance, but with real good design, I'm convinced unmanned maintenance of Hubble is possible. Seems like nobody's discussing that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, maybe if everything goes smoothly, but some of those repair missions. Remember that one guy who was from New York? Mike? His last name. Well, he was up there and he needed to get to a part, get the panel open. And they finally, they couldn't get it open. They were trying to unbolt this handle that was in their way that they needed to move to get the I think they were going to change out a part of the computer or something. So maybe the power supply or whatever it was, and they needed to get to this. So I just finally decided, well, suppose I just break this handle off, you know. Well, use all this force, actually broke the handle off, you know, and they gave them the okay to do that, and it worked. I finally brought that handle back from it, the souvenir. So, I mean, could a robot do that? Yeah, well, they could probably design it, but they'd have to know that before they went up. So if problems came up, you could have a, you know, maybe a $500 million mission that might not work out. That's probably what they're thinking. I think you need a crew up there, Dick. As far as Hubble replacement, you have the James Webb Space Telescope, but then you've got that's going up there. It's going to be a planet hunter. That's got full of photo detectors similar to Kepler. Again, that really doesn't replace Hubble. But you do have the WFIRST going up. They got to get the funding straightened out, but this thing has been planned for many years. And if this thing goes, that would be a good replacement. For every one picture they said that it would take, it would be equivalent to 100 pictures of what Hubble needs. So, I mean, if you want to believe all that, there's a WFIRST, got a wide field type of mirror on board. And I think we've talked about WFIRST before. You're aware of that, aren't you, Dick? WS1.
Hey, give me a few more words on WFIRST. If it goes through, is it bigger than Hubble? If it's going to take 100 times more effective pictures than Hubble, does that mean it's got 100 times more area or 100 times more sensitivity of its detectors? So if it's a potential Hubble replacement, what does it have that makes it so much better, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, the only thing I've read, really, probably one article regarding sensitivity of it, 100 times the field of what Hubble can see, but with the same clarity. I don't know how that's possible, but that's where we need Craig. But you're good with telescopes. Maybe you could confirm that or not. It doesn't sound possible that you could have roughly the same size telescope having 100 times the field of view with the same type of clarity. Now let me give you an idea of what this thing is. It, you know, when they built Hubble, it was, what, a little over 8 foot mirror, right? So like, what, 2.5 meter or something. So rough, let's call it an 8 foot mirror. Well, back then, what we didn't know is that they were also building two more mirrors. You know, this one mirror, you know, I'm sure it came out of the NASA budget, but we also have a space military budget. From what I've read, is like twice the amount of money that NASA can get. So it comes out of the defense budget. They built two other mirrors, and they built it for the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. In the beginning of the night, I was talking about SpaceX sending up the Falcon 9, putting a spacecraft into orbit for the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. And this is really a listening group. They go up and listen and see, you know, what they do. Now, they've been doing this for decades. When this thing was being developed, these two mirrors that were never put up into space by the NRO, the NRO was even, nobody even knew what it was. It was hidden in the military budget. I think it wasn't until the 90s, I think Clinton, that eventually they said, hey, there's the NRO, so this thing has existed forever. We drop it. Well, the NRO was going to take these two mirrors and put them in a telescope and not point it sort of Milky Way to see what's out there. They were going to point it down to Earth and see what was going on in, you know, in all these foreign countries. But apparently they didn't need this. Don't know why. Maybe they had. Maybe there's two other mirrors. Maybe they already put one up there. We don't know that. But these two mirrors were left over, and they've been sitting around in the warehouse forever. And they turned around to NASA and they said, you know, if you want two of these, NASA said, sure, we'll take one of them. And this is, I don't know how many years ago. It's got to be 5, 6 years ago that I first started reading about this. And they decided, let's build a telescope. And they have developed the idea of building the WFIRST telescope. And this present plan, originally it was going to be in orbit around the Earth. Now the present plan is to take WFIRST and put it out by L2, position out by James Webb. Keep James Webb Space Telescope Company. Back to you, Dick. That's the story on WFIRST.
Yeah, L2 has got a huge advantage in that it's now in orbit around the sun. Is that true? No, it's on the back side of the moon. So it's instead of a 90 minute orbit, it's a 28 day orbit. So aiming becomes a lot easier at L2. I got that correct. Let me think now.
Two different L2s.
Okay, so the main L2 that we're going for is an orbit around the sun. Is that true?
QSL, yeah. We're talking L2. We're talking sun, Earth, spacecraft. So, sun, Earth, James Webb Space Telescope, and also sun, Earth, now WFIRST out there with James Webb as well. Back to you.
Okay, so James Webb is going to be at L2, sun, Earth, L2, and WFIRST is also going to be out there. So, it's a very desirable location, the backside of the Earth. Therefore, Earth is a partial shield towards the sun, a lot less flare light, and a lot slower orbit, so a lot easier to aim. That's the good news. The bad news is that, except for some huge investment as a repair robot, there's never going to be any service. And so all the service missions of Hubble have increased its capability. I'm going to pick a number, 50-fold, something huge. Without those service missions, Hubble would be 1% of what it turned into. So without a repair robot, W1st is going to have a huge lack of repair capability, as is James Webb. So for both of those, I think we've got to build a repair robot, pole, because no matter how good a job you do on a telescope, let me drop it. I think the past history has told us the day will always come when you want to replace a solar panel, you want to replace an inertial wheel, you want to replace a power supply, you want to replace a battery, you want to replace a computer, you want to replace a detector assembly. There's always new detectors being invented, always new batteries being invented, always new solar cells being invented. So you made a huge investment to put this fantastic mirror on a prime piece of real estate out there at L2. But the mirror becomes useless if all of the electronics connected to it is not kept in perfect condition. And no matter how careful you are, you can't anticipate all of the potential failures of that much hardware. So updating and repair, there's no way of getting around that. You and I haven't heard, I'm guessing you and I haven't heard any words yet about how updates and repair of James Webb are going to take place. With all the history we've got on Hubble, I think there's a 98% chance that 4 years after you install James Webb, you're going to want to do a repair or an update. They've got to start talking about a robot that can do remote repair, is my belief, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I agree. I haven't read anything where they're going to send any robots out for either one of those telescopes. By the way, how's my transmission? I'm going in through Selman.
The quietest I've ever heard. Beautiful signal.
Yeah, I think I'll give my radio a rest and go in that way. All right, very good. The robot capability would be necessary if you needed a new solar panel or something like that. That might be doable. But if it's something unusual, for instance, a month or two ago, they took James Webb Space Telescope and put it in this big vacuum chamber and chilled everything down and tried to duplicate the conditions of deep space. And then they put it through these vibration tests. And as they were doing it, vibration started to occur and it automatically shut everything down. It took them a while to find it, but about a week or two ago, they did locate the problem. And it, you know that James Webb is a 21-foot diameter mirror, so 7-meter thing. Well, they have 18 different hexagonal-shaped mirrors within this diameter, making up that whole mirror. On the end, you have three big mirrors on one side, three big mirrors on the fourth side. They fold back when it gets launched. It's got to fit inside the Ariane 5 rocket bearing. So it folds back, and then you have a clamp that clamps that place. They found out through multiple tests that I forget how many millimeters or something. It was just, you know, you couldn't see it, but it just was not locking it in tight enough. Drop it. WS2N. So they found a little vibration, and, you know, I mean, that's so minor. But suppose you had fixed something like that. Not that that would matter. It would already be open out there. But some other thing that was, you know, almost impossible to maybe even locate, never mind fix, when you have a problem. There's nothing like a human capability to go out there, but going out 1 million miles, trying to come back, you know, that would be asking a lot. I think you'd need a couple of SLS systems to do something like that. So, that was just resolved anyway. And by the way, this thing will be launched from French Guiana. And it looks like that problem that they had in French Guiana with the unrest, the citizens of French Guiana has been solved.
W2YY.
Quick courtesy come. So that problem has been solved. So the first flight, which was a Brazilian and another satellite on board too, I forget where that one was going, but the first one was Brazil, I think the other one was Mexico. That flight, which should have gone off a month and a half ago, is now going to be launched on May 4th, coming up a couple of days from now. So, and they have a couple of other things in the queue that are waiting, and once they take care of that, good news, because it won't affect James Webb, which is next September. You know, we don't want that to be delayed. Back to you, the K2RIWWS one.
Yep, Joe wants to ask us a question. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Hi there. With all the improvements that were done to the Hubble Space Telescope, how much further is James Webb going to be at? Well, I should say, how much further. How much more powerful is James Webb going to be compared to Hubble? Just looking at visual light, because I know James Webb, I think, is capable of doing, like, IR and going above the band of light to, like, X-rays, cosmic rays. I think it's got a lot more detectors than Hubble probably has in it. But just looking at light, how much more powerful will it be? Back to you.
It's a little bit hard to make a comparison, but we're talking about an 8-foot mirror on Hubble, and I think it's an 18-foot diameter mirror. Is it 18 or is it 24? It's something like 20-foot diameter mirror on James Webb. The James Webb mirror made in, I think it's 18 sections. Paul's going to correct us on the diameter, but it's a lot bigger diameter. But it's covered in gold, so it is primarily in infrared. I think James Webb has got a little bit of optical capability. I think it has no ultraviolet, is my guess. Paul's going to correct us on all of this. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, 21 feet in diameter, 18 mirrors. And it's got a secondary mirror and a tertiary mirror as well. And the 21 feet compared to Hubble, so it's, you know, three times the diameter, almost. So it's a large difference. And covered in gold, mounted on beryllium. Beryllium won't expand or contract under any kind of, coldness. So that was important. If that had changed the shape, it would change the shape of the mirrors. I guess we'll figure it out. We'll see what happens. And they said the gold coating is excellent for receiving infrared light. But yeah, it does have visual capability as well. So soon after the years go by and they lose the capability of infrared, they'll still be able to use it for visual to some degree. It doesn't have a big tube around it like the Hubble, like a typical telescope, because it is infrared. It drops. All its big tube around it would do is actually create heat. You're looking at that heat. So it's just this open mirror sitting out in space with a big sunshade the size of a tennis court blocking the sun. So that's about it. And it's only about $8 billion. A little over $8 billion now. it sounds like a lot, but it is over probably, 10 to 12 years time frame back here.
When you compare a 21-foot diameter mirror with an 8-foot diameter mirror, and you take the ratio of the two and square it in order to calculate the area, James Webb has 7 times more area. And so... 7 times more area would give you 7 times more, what's the word for it now, resolution, angular resolution, if the wavelengths are the same. But the infrared is 1 or 2 times longer in wavelength, so that wipes out some of that. So James Webb is going to have a little bit more resolution than Hubble, but at infrared frequencies. and the infrared frequencies, to my knowledge, do a much better job of penetrating clouds. So there's a lot of galaxies and things like that are hidden behind clouds that you'll be able to see with Hubble, with James Webb, that you can't see with Hubble. I've got a question for you, Paul. Let me drop it. The Soviets launched Salyut 1, 2, 5, 7, a whole bunch of Salyut space station-like things, and then eventually a Mir space station. I am guessing that all of the Salyuts have re-entered, and I think Mir has also re-entered. So, is it true that the Soviets joined our international space station, and they have no longer any Soviet space stations or Russian space stations in orbit at this time? Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, as far as I know, the Salyut, last Salyut station, probably, I think that's going to, I'm not sure if that's deorbited or not. Probably dead by now. It's not useful. But the only thing that they have is the International Space Station. Someday they plan, everybody has plans, but one of the possibilities is this, at the end of the life of this International Space Station is to disconnect one or two of their modules, and that will become part of their own space station. It's just a long-term thing that they're thinking about. But right now, yeah, this is the only game in town. Us and the Chinese will have the new one up probably toward the end of next year.
Too bad the Chinese and the International Space Station Consortium weren't able to combine forces, because isn't there some degree of duplication of effort of the Chinese putting up all of these space stations? The International Space Station Group is putting up more and more modules on their space station, and so it would have been more efficient if a greater combination had taken place as opposed to these separate efforts. A little hard for me to believe that the Chinese on their space station are planning experiments that are so different, and therefore they need a separate space station to do it, as compared to the International Space Station. What's your thoughts on this, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, Space Report.
Well, I guess if they want to find out a lot of the things that we found out on their own, they're going to need their own space station. Anything else? But right now they haven't, I guess it has to do with sanctions, whatever goes on with politics. We've got presently, 21 different countries involved, maybe 21 or 20 countries involved with the International Space Station. We've got Japan, the United States, and Russia, along with the European Space Agency, which make up quite a few different countries. We've got Canada involved. They supply all the robotic arms and things. Everybody has either supplied material for getting there, or robotic arms on the space station, or actually financially involved to some degree. But everybody pretty much kicks in. European Space Agency's got their own module up there called Columbus. We, of course, have our own Destiny module. That's our scientific module. We put up all the nodes, the interconnecting modules. Japanese have put up really like 2.5 big modules. Actually, one of the biggest modules up there is the Japanese module. So they have really like 1.5 modules, but they have a porch that's as big as a module. So three space shuttles to put up the Japanese contribution of the International Space Station. And the Russians have theirs, quite a few different components on their end. And China, I guess, was not part of that you know, back then, especially, and still now. I guess they could always change in the future. You know, if there's another trip to the moon, they're not invited. If they go, we're not invited back to there.
Trump and China. Started off with a pretty rocky beginning interface. Because we both are worried about North Korea, I'd like to believe that it's going to be a kind of joining of forces, a cooperation between the United States and China. As such, by way of the mischief being created by North Korea, it's possible that our relationships in the next couple of years with China will improve, in which case, could China have become part of the consortium, the 21 countries that are part of the International Space Station? Now, I don't think the consortium of the International Space Station, that group of 20 countries as a group, correct me on this, I don't think they're planning any lunar base operations. But I think China is talking about lunar base operations sometime in the next one or two decades. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, back in the early 90s, China had a, they called it Project 921. And the 9 stood for 1990. And whatever it was, they had this long-term plan, and they've been following it all along, you know, to, you know, start putting people up in space. They've done that quite a few times since, what, 2000, and I think it was 2003 was their first launch of one person in space, and then two, and then eventually three. And they're following this whole program along. They wanted a space station that was part of it. They wanted to send a robotic mission to the moon. They've succeeded in that with Chang 3. They landed out on the moon. And, they had the little rover come out and last for a while. And then they have future plans to drop. I think within a year or two, they plan on sending a mission to the moon. And they want to land, soft land on the dark side of the moon. They want to put a satellite up and, you know, to transmit information back from that mission, from that one flight. Then they plan on doing the same thing and having a sample return. And then sometime after that, you know, they have plans on eventually sending people to land on the moon. So they have plans. India has really long-term plans. You know, it might happen for 15, 20, 30 years, you know. They have an ultimate goal. They're developing a manned space capsule that could eventually launch. So, you know, if we ever go back, right now we have no permanent plans of doing that. Possible cislunar orbit, that's a possibility coming up for us, but not actually going down to the surface. So, Russians also have a plan. They're building the Federation spacecraft. Federation spacecraft is going to carry four people and be able to not only go to the International Space Station or eventually their own space station in the future if they plan on doing that, but also to the moon. So they haven't given up on that idea. Back to you.
Question. And we are. Rich recognized, but let me ask first, Paul. If China is expecting to put men on the moon sometime in the next one or two decades, is that a three-day Apollo-like mission? Or do they intend to put men on the moon for longer than 3 days? And if so, how are they going to protect them from those crazy high and low temperatures? Have they discussed any of those details? And it sounds good on paper, but I think there's a lot of degree of difficulty of putting them up at the North Pole, where you think the temperature is going to be more constant, but still very cold, as I see it. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. Well, everybody has their plans, but nothing worked out yet. European Space Agency, they actually have a drawing of their their base on the moon, and part of it's on the ground, and which is feasible, you know. So we'll have to wait and see their long-term plans. But yeah, China's original plan will be to send people there and then bring them back like anything else, you know. And then after that, their goal, they have a goal of actually putting a base on the moon many years from now, that's for sure. They've already soft landed on the moon, put a rover. Their next step is to actually really land something on the dark side of the moon, and then also probably on the front side of the moon, having a sample return. Naturally, we've brought back rocks. We've brought back a total of over 800 pounds of rocks right with the people. Russians brought some stuff back too, but without sending people. And Rich wanted to say something back either.
In the so-called dark side of the moon, we probably should call it the back side of the moon. There is no dark side. Every front and back surface of the moon gets equal amount of light, just that we don't see the so-called back side. So I think we should call it the back side. Yes, a lot of people do call it the dark side, but maybe that's not the best thing to call it. But if they're going to put something on the surface, without putting it 60 meters below the surface where the temperature is more constant, I don't think there's any kind of a structure that you and I can envision that can tolerate plus 160 degrees centigrade on the surface for half a day on the moon, which is 12 solid Earth days. 12 solid Earth days of nearly 160 degrees Fahrenheit. With real good air conditioning, maybe. But boy, if that air conditioner hiccups during that 12-day high noon, it's game over real fast. Has anybody discussed that vulnerability over your pole, K2RIW?
No. I mean, I've read if there's problems, you know, they get into their rocket and take off, you know. So, you know, abort. You know, we had it with our guys when they went, you know. Right after they landed at Tranquility Base, first thing they were doing was, you know, we stay or do we go? You know, they went throughout, you know, they polled everybody, you know, they looked at the telemetry. You know, I mean, right after they landed, they could have hit that abort button right away if there's a problem. And that's the way it was, you know, if they woke up in the middle of the night when they were sleeping, if they woke them up and they said, "Let's, you know, something's wrong, get in there and go," they would have been gone. Like you and the N2EO is up.
N2EO, make a beep and go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Something that always interested me. When the space race with the Russians was really going strong, it was a rumor. I don't know if it was a rumor or the truth. That's why I'm bringing it up. It was around 1965. There was something going around. I was a school kid. And they said that the Russians tried to land a man on the moon for us, that the lunar excursion module crashed, and they were hushing it up. You guys ever hear that? Think back here.
Now that we know the degree of difficulty of the only way you can get there without building something 10 times bigger than Saturn V, which is out of the question. The only way you can get there is by lunar orbit rendezvous of a lunar module, tiny little craft compared to the main thing you launch, that really goes down to the surface. In order to do lunar orbit rendezvous, lunar module type landing, you've got to be real good at doing a redocking, coming back up from the surface, making sure your orbit is properly aligned in altitude, apogee, perigee, inclination of orbit, timing. All of that's got to be just right, and you don't link up. And so, way back at the time frame you're talking about, nobody had the hardware to do that. Nobody had the practice to do that. And without that practice to get all the bugs out of that lunar orbit rendezvous, it never survived it. So for there to be a rumor that somebody tried, I believe it. Did they really launch a human being and lose him on the moon? I highly doubt it. Let's see what Paul thinks about that. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, well, there was a good movie that came out a couple of years ago called Moon. And they had this guy, he was on the moon all by himself mining stuff. They were sending things back, they had magnetic launches, sending all the minerals back to Earth. And through the course of this movie, eventually they discovered this other vehicle on the moon. That was the Russian. Guy had died in it, you know. So I guess those rumors get eventually caught up, and people start writing science fiction books and movies. But it, you know, that never happened. The only thing that's close to that reality, to have something like that can get started, is they did have a spacecraft designed to land on the moon, and their plan was to land not two men but one man on the moon. They're going to send a crew of two. One guy was going to stay in orbit around the moon, and they were going to send the guy down and land. But it never worked out. The N1 rocket, let me drop it. The N1 rocket that was designed to do all this, get them off the Earth, was a massive rocket. It was bigger than the, had more thrust than the Saturn V rocket. Saturn V had 7.5 million pounds. The N1 had 10 million pounds of thrust. So, but they had many failures. In fact, one of the failures killed, I don't know how many people, a couple hundred people or something on the around the launch complex. So, you know, they just couldn't do it. That was their goal, to take a lot of these engines, put them all together, and that was the way they do it. They were going to launch just, you know, some 30 or 40 engines instead of five rocket engines like we did. On the Saturn V. Let me drop. But in 1962, NASA, they had this plan for building a very big rocket. One was called the Nova, but the other one was D-Dragon, they called it. And they were going to build this thing, and it was going to launch from the sea. It was going to float it out in the ocean, and it was going to launch from underwater. You know, the bottom part of it was going to go down. Going to take off, and the amount of thrust had 10 times the amount. It's funny you said that thing. 10 times the amount that the Saturn V had. Saturn V was 7.5 million. This is going to be like 80 million pounds of thrust, and that's what they were thinking about in 1962. Of course, and they were going to use one engine. There was this one engine that was going to put out 80 million pounds of thrust. It was all by itself, just one big engine. The diameter of the thing was, they said 75 feet with a diameter of, I think, Saturn V, what was that, 24 feet or something. A lot of things were thought about in the 1960s. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Yes, I think it was the N1 that had a very large number of individual rocket motors with an extremely complicated piping system to feed fuel and oxidizer to all of those individual motors. And when you got that many individual motors, the only choice is to have that many individual pumping mechanisms, which gets very elaborate, very fast. Either that, you start building up instabilities in the fuel flow between the individual engines. And I think they ran into instability problems, if I remember, Paul. So you'd have to have auxiliary power units or turbines controlling the pressure of fuel and oxidizer and all of these very large number of engines. So if you're trying to build something 10 times bigger than Saturn V, you don't just simply make an engine 10 times bigger. On paper, that sounds good. Those engines don't scale. It's like saying, if an ant was the size of a human being, he'd be able to lift 50,000 pounds. Well, not really. The strength of a leg bone doesn't scale. Just because you've scaled it up 100 times doesn't make it 100 times stronger relativistically. So certain things don't scale, and rocket engines don't scale. You want 10 times the thrust, you're going to take your best engine and use 10 times as many of them, and then you've got this huge stability problem. I think that's what they ran into, and I believe in the early Russian equivalent of the Apollo program, I think that hung them up. WS2N for some corrections, K2LIW.
Yeah, I forget how many engines they had, and you can't count the, if you look at the bottom, you can't count the amount of funnels or cones that you see sticking out of the bottom. Sometimes one engine has two or four, but they use a version of the NK-33. NK-33 was somewhat reliable back then, but not when you put them all together, and that's when they had problems with the fuel flow and all of that. So then one of the turbines, now each rocket has a series of turbines that supports the fuel into the rocket, you know, the chamber. So one of these things, I believe, let go, and then because that one let go, you know, it caused a chain reaction, and the whole thing blew up. So SpaceX is kind of faced with the same kind of challenge. They don't have the NK-33, a much more reliable engine that's used additive manufacturing, which is really 3D manufacturing, to develop their Merlin 1D engine, which are up. So when they launch the Falcon 9, they have 9 engines. They don't have, you know, 30 some odd engines that, you know, or more that the N1 had. But toward the end of this year, when they launched the Falcon Heavy that we talked about at the beginning of the net, they're really taking 3 Falcon 9 engines and putting them together. So now they're launching 27 engines at the same time. They think they have that under control. They, you know, with all today's computers, technology, seem to be doing okay. I remember they had one early flight where one of the engines cut out on them. But they have it designed where, you know, the 8 engines are powerful enough to get their payload to orbit. They're okay. But so far, they've been doing pretty good. All 9 keep going. They make it to maximum Q, and then they separate. And they have another Merlin 1D engine on the second stage, and using the same fuel and oxidizer. And it's just identical engines set up for vacuum use. Working in a vacuum, and that pushes them to orbit. And they've been successful at it, so let's see what happens when they put 27 of these engines together. That's what I want to say. Back to you.
27 engines. I can picture what that looks like when you look at the back end of that rocket assembly. And some of those 27 engines are near the perimeter, so outside airflow creates a certain pattern around those engines. The engines that are closer to the center of the assembly don't have outside airflow. Therefore, they're going to behave rather differently. The local external air pressure is not going to be the same. So try to keep that all stable. And by the way, all the dynamics of the airflow around the perimeter versus the center is all changing drastically as you go through maximum Q. As the whole assembly is below the speed of sound or above the speed of sound. So some kind of all kinds of servo mechanism adjustments are probably required to keep everything stable. When you've got that many engines, let me drop it.
Yeah, it's not quite that way. Yeah, I mean, you're describing the N1, but Falcon 9 is heavy different.
Well, we're still talking about a large number of engines. And of all the failure mechanisms that an engine can have, the engine just fails in a cutoff mode, and the remaining thrust is enough. You can sort of live with that as long as not too many of them fail. But that's if it fails by cutoff. If it fails by exploding, there is no escape mechanism you can use in a case like that, Paul, is my understanding. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I agree. I think they'll probably be able to do it. They know the rocket pretty good after up to over 30 flights now. Now the original Falcon 9 was, they had the engines, you know, three in a row. They weren't in a big circle. 1, 2, 3, and then another on top. 1, 2, 3, and then, you know, and then another one. So it looked like a box of configuration. So they went with that for the first, five flights or so, and then they changed it to this octaform type of thing with one engine in the middle and then surrounded the circumference, you know, around the middle, then they have the eight engines. And that's the way they do it. So then you'll have booster will look, the core engine will look like that, and then the two boosters, which will be side by side, one on one side, one on the other side, will also look exactly like that. So that's what you'll be looking at the bottom. Three center engines and 24 engines going around the circumference of each single engine. It'll get up, 2 minutes of flight. The other two boosters will separate and come back and land back at LV1. They both land on land. And then the core engine will take this payload and the second stage up to orbit, and that'll separate. And then again, you'll have just the one engine pushing the payload to orbit, and that core stage will come back and land on the autonomous barge 400 miles out to sea. So they plan on saving all three boosters, two boosters and one core stage.
Is this going to be a three-stage rocket assembly, and the first two stages are recoverable, and they'll fly back home, Paul? Is that what we're saying?
You have three going up at the same time. One in the middle, that's the core stage, and then the two boosters, one to the left, one to the right. So, yeah, those two will come back to Cape Canaveral at landing zone one. They've already, leveled the ground out, and they're ready for that. They've landed already three single stages, coming back at that location. So, the core stage will continue on, and similar to what they do now, when they land out in the ocean, that core stage will come back and land on the barge 400 miles out to the ocean. So all three boosters, they're planning on saving all three and then reusing them somewhere down the road.
We got a little bit of ambiguity here, Paul. Stages of the rocket, first, second, and third stage, and at least the first and maybe the second stage can come back home. The word booster, in some cases the word booster means an external solid rocket booster. To my knowledge, nothing with a solid rocket booster has come back home with its solid rocket booster casing. So I am guessing that anything that uses a solid rocket booster, at some stage in the takeoff, you disconnect the solid rocket boosters, you jettison that. I don't think it flies back home, the SRB, but the liquid fuel center section does come back home. Correct me on some of that, Paul. K2LAW.
Yeah, I know the history of rocketry has changed when it comes to first stage, second, third, and third stage. You think of the Apollo. You had first stage, second stage, third stage, one on top of one, one on top of one another. And as time went by, they started taking solid rocket boosters and attaching them to the side of the vehicle. You saw that with the Titan IIIC. You would launch the voyages to the outer planets or Cassini to Saturn. You would have the center stage of the Titan rocket, and then you have the two solid boosters on the outside. And then, what do you call these things? So the Russians decided to V they have a similar type of thing with the Soyuz. They have the center booster, the liquid fuels, and then you have four boosters attached to the four auxiliary boosters attached to that center core. So it's like almost like having five individual rockets going up. Let me drop it. So they call the first stage of flight the four boosters that separate the four liquid boosters that separate that are attached to the side of the core. They call that the first stage. Then they call the core stage, they call that the second stage. And then that goes up to orbit, and then that eventually separates. And then there's another rocket that pushes the crew to the International Space Station, and I think that's the third stage. The terminology, you know, and India is doing the same thing with their, they have a polar launch vehicle, and then they have the geosynchronous launch vehicle, and they have attached boosters to it. So it's in the terminology. So when I talk about the first stage for Falcon 9 Heavy, to me that would be the two boosters that are attached to it. Then the second stage is the core stage, so using similar to what the Russians have used. And then the third stage is the Merlin D, the one engine that is attached to the top. Let me drop it. And as far as solid booster casings coming back, yeah, they've actually reused the space shuttle boosters. They all came back with parachutes. They would take the cores and rebuild them and relaunch those things. After they landed in the sea, they pick them up with the boat, bring it back, and rework the casing. You know, a lot of work to do that, but that's, you know, in a sense that they were actually reusable back in
the day. The solid rocket boosters on Apollo, space shuttle. What's your guess as to the maximum number of times one of those casings was reused, Paul? And I guess now we've also got to discuss the old design versus the new design after Columbia. Go ahead.
There were some parts, skirt of the original booster that went up on Columbia. There's some one part that was eventually used a number of times. Eventually, it was on STS-135, something NASA had on that. It made it through, countless flights, but I couldn't answer that. But a lot of parts were reused over the years. They were making new ones all the time, but, you know, parts, you know, they would put, like, part one, you know, not the whole booster, you know, they were segmented parts. They were four segmented pieces for each solid rocket booster. So maybe, you know, part A was not so good, and they would use part B or something. Back to you, Jerry.
Yeah, I said Columbia, and I should have said Challenger. The O-ring failure was Challenger, and that's where the seal mechanisms on the SRBs had to be redesigned. The metal deflection was making it too risky, particularly on a cold day. So when it comes to reusing the casings of SRBs, there's a little bit of a problem of describing the casings before and after Challenger. So you do believe that some of those casings were reused maybe more than two or three times, Paul, K2IW?
I believe that, yeah, quite a few times. You know, they always came back on parachutes, landed in the sea. Now, Aryan 5 has boosters as well, two big boosters. And they had parachutes on some of the flights, and they would just take them to study them, but they did not reuse any of the parts like we did. So, but, you know, I know all the joints and everything were all reworked out. You know, they were all new. So when Challenger failed, I'm sure that was, you know, I don't know if there were any reused parts on that flight. or not, but it was the general design that was there that allowed the gas to pass it, pass through, and then they started it with some kind of a J type of design. If you look at it, it looked like a J, and they had changed.